New jobless claims fall to a 17-month low.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This is the Morning Report for Thursday, December 31st at Marketplace.org. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to the Morning Open. Wall Street is just starting its day and ending its year. We're looking at some fresh economic news. New claims for unemployment benefits fell, and new mortgage rules take effect tomorrow. What are these developments mean for the economy and for you? That's just ahead. First, where's Wall Street? Stocks initially rose a little on that upbeat news on jobless claims. They're pretty flat now. S&P 500 and the NASDAQ up far less than 1%, just a fraction. And the Dow is down less than 1 point. It's at 10,547. This is in light holiday trading. European stocks are mostly lower, less than 1%. Asian markets rose slightly today. It was quite a year for Asian stocks. Shanghai's main index was up 80% in 2009. Hong Kong, more than 50%. Japan's Nikkei, only 19%. So, as I said, we learned this morning the number of workers filing new applications for jobless benefits fell last week to the lowest level in 17 months. Is this another reason to pop champagne tonight or not? Let's bring in Chief Economist Diane Swonk at Mesirow Financial, joining us live from Chicago. Happy Almost New Year, Diane.
Happy Almost New Year.
I guess it's 2010 in Australia now.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So new jobless claims fell last week to the lowest level since July of 2008. Significant or not?
It is significant. It is a bit seasonal, a little bit of a head fake, but the bottom line is the trend's been in the right direction. Last month we lost only 11,000 jobs. It sounds terrible to say only 11,000, but we had been losing 750,000 by January of a year ago. So we could be to that tipping point where we're finally, if we don't see positive in December, I think we will see positive numbers in January, helped out a bit by the government hiring census workers. But frankly, I don't care how we get it at this stage of the game. I'd like to see some positive employment numbers out there.
Yeah, there's something magical about actually hearing in December next week, possibly, that in December there was a net gain. Just give me a percentage. What are the odds?
I think it's more than 50%. I think we're right at that tipping point, maybe 55-60% chance we do get a slight positive. It would be, you know, small positive, but frankly, we'll take it. We'll take anything we can get. That movement from negative into positive is a very important move for us.
Yes, yeah. What about the official unemployment rate? We tend to focus on that. It's at 10% now. What do you figure for December?
You know, I think that's going to actually creep up a little bit. The problem is, you know, as the job picture starts to shift, all those people who aren't saying they're unemployed right now, who are discouraged, rejoin the labor force. And so initially the unemployment rate, even as you start to generate jobs, rises for several months right into probably March or April of next year, probably hitting close to 10.5% when all is said and done. But the good news is, even though more people are going to be lining up with you to apply for those jobs, as long as they're generating more, we're on the part of regaining our ground and climbing ourselves out of a very deep hole for the last 2 years.
Okay. Chief Economist Diane Swonk at Mesirow Financial, a very happy new year to you. Thanks for talking with us
you know,
all through the year, and it's good to hear your voice again. Bye-bye now. Starting tomorrow, there are new mortgage rules in town. The feds have overhauled the old Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, RESPA, to help homebuyers know what they're getting into when they take out a mortgage. Marketplace's Elisa Roth joins us now, live from our New York bureau. Morning, Elisa.
Good morning.
So these new and improved rules, are they going to help homeowners, help homebuyers, and how?
Well, as you alluded to, for a long time, lenders have had to give borrowers what's called a good faith estimate. It's an idea of how much everything is going to end up costing. So that's things like the broker's fee, what are the closing costs, how much does title insurance cost. Now, the problem was that there was no standardized format for that estimate, so it could be really hard for the borrower to know how much it was really going to end up costing. So with the new rules, lenders will have to make it really clear that, for example, borrowers can shop around for title insurance.
There was so much talk during the housing crisis that people took out mortgages they didn't understand. Is this going to be enough to really change that?
It's going to be an improvement. I talked to Chris Mayer this morning. He's a professor at Columbia University's Business School, and the way he described it is a step in the right direction.
I think it is a very challenging process to take somebody who is applying for a mortgage and give them a piece of paper that provides adequate financial education.
You know, on the other hand, a lot of people in the mortgage industry are saying that the new regulations go too far and that these rules are really going to slow things down too much, which would be bad for the real estate industry.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth, joining us live from our New York bureau. Thanks, Elisa. Happy New Year.
You're welcome. Thank you. You too.
As the clock strikes midnight in Asia, the world's newest free trade zone is born. China is getting together with a group of Southeast Asian countries known as ASEAN. We're talking about a trade bloc to rival NAFTA and the European Union in size. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
In with the new, out with the tariffs. Duties on some 7,000 products traded between China and Southeast Asia are all going away on New Year's Day. Lots of those products are parts, if you think of the region as one big cross-border assembly line. Rodolfo Severino is with the Institute for Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore.
If Southeast Asian components get into China at less cost, and China assembles them, then the goods will become cheaper.
That's good for consumers. But furniture makers in Indonesia are asking to keep the tariffs. They fear competition from China will pummel them, especially as Beijing holds its currency artificially cheap. Malcolm Cook at the Lowy Institute in Sydney says many Southeast Asian countries have a trade deficit with China.
The growing strength of China and the shift in trade flows is without a doubt increasing some concerns about Chinese competition in the region.
The China-ASEAN trade deal still protects industries deemed sensitive, like Indonesian popcorn and toilet paper from China. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
In Britain, the end of the year means the government's annual honors list. It's a reward for service to the UK. Notably absent on this year's list, bankers. As Marketplace's Stephen Beard tells us, only one is being recognized.
Usually, the banking profession is showered with titles at this time of year, many bankers receiving the right to call themselves Lord, Lady, Dame, or Sir for their services to the British economy. This year, however, the bankers are in disgrace. The government has nominated only one for an honour.
I don't think even one ought to be get an honour this year, if you believe in this system.
Professor Stephen Hazler is a critic of the honours system. He dismisses the whole exercise as pointless and antiquated.
Things like knighthoods, evoking images of people riding along with armor and jousting and all that kind of stuff. It's an absolutely archaic system.
Nevertheless, many Brits take it seriously, and it does give the British government a way of making its displeasure felt. In this year's list, the Lord Mayor of London has been denied the traditional knighthood because it's claimed he defended bankers' bonuses. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If you ring in 2010 with a glass of American wine tonight, you will be helping make it a happier new year for the U.S. wine industry. From the wine country of California, Kaomi Getz has more.
Stu Smith grows grapes for his small winery, Smith Madrone, nestled in the hills of Napa County. He says a lot of people in his industry are struggling these days.
They estimated that 20% of the Sonoma County grape crop would be left on the vine. That's pretty startling.
Smith says he hasn't seen anything like it in his 40 years in the business. Growers are letting their grapes rot rather than take a bath trying to sell them in a glutted market. Distributors are still trying to unload back inventory from last year. Small wineries that sell to restaurants are having abysmal sales. Smith says it's causing a lot of jitters.
Are we looking at a new paradigm, or are things going to get better after the next 6 months or a year? And everybody goes back to their old ways. You know, I don't know.
Positive spinners will tell you people are still drinking wine. That's true. But fewer are buying wines that cost $30 or more.
What's interesting about this recession that's quite different from the last two is the effect on the baby boomers.
Christian Miller researches the wine industry. He says people in their late 40s to early 60s drove the upscale wine market even during past recessions.
This recession, because it's impacted their wealth significantly, has had a much more significant impact on the outlook and purchasing of the baby boomers.
Upmarket labels are scrambling to find the new selling sweet spot. Some wineries are offering as much as half off and free shipping on the internet. And with distributors hurting, analysts say wineries are increasingly trying to bypass stores and restaurants to connect with consumers directly. I'm Kaomi Getz for Marketplace.
As experts and politicians try to figure out why our financial system broke last year, many fingers are pointing to one legislative action, the 1999 repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. So what was Glass-Steagall? Why did we junk it? And can we ever go back? Marketplace's economics correspondent Chris Farrell is here with the story. Morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Glass-Steagall. It takes you back to a simpler time.
Oh, yes, it really does. It was the Depression-era law that separated commercial banking from investment banking, from insurance companies. The image of the time was of a ship. So with a ship, you have the hold, and it has divisions. So if you get a leak in one part of the hold, you can shut off the rest of the ship. You can isolate it.
So if the ship was floating and the compartments were compartmentalized and all was well, why did we mess with that?
What happened with Glass-Steagall is that it was eroded over time because, well, now we live in this global economy, and there's all kinds of competition. Everything got mixed together. Financial institutions would go to Washington and say, you know, these regulations are preventing us from making profits. We're losing out to the Europeans. We're losing out to the Japanese. So over time, the divisions broke down.
So it sounds like you're kind of defending that action, that it wasn't just either idiotic or venal.
The 1999 Act that repealed Glass-Steagall was not idiotic, although there was an awful lot of lobbying money that was spent. I do have to say that. But it was acknowledging the world. Here's how I look at things today. Is there really a difference between AIG, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America? I don't think so. That's the world we have to regulate. I love Glass-Steagall because it did work for a while. And you know what it does? It protects grandma's money. And that's a good thing. But I don't think it's the right regulation for a global economy.
So then how do we protect grandma's money today?
And this is where there's a lot of creative ideas out there. And the ones that I like essentially say there is no difference between an AIG, a Goldman Sachs, a Bank of America. They all need to be regulated the same. We need to create essentially a system where if they get into trouble, they automatically go into bankruptcy, management is wiped out, existing shareholders are wiped out, and we isolate the problem that way. But we need to regulate them all the same because the fact of the matter is, Bill, they're all in the same businesses these days.
Marketplace's economics correspondent Chris Farrell with that. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
It is widely rumored that Google is going to unveil its new smartphone next week. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman fills us in on the buzz.
Several technology websites are speculating that the internet giant will unveil its own smartphone called the Nexus One on Tuesday. With features like a touchscreen, Wi-Fi web access, and apps galore, it'll be a direct competitor to Apple's iPhone. It'll reportedly come with a T-Mobile contract for $180, but for just over $500, there'll be a version that's not locked to T-Mobile's network or anyone else's. Kent German follows the cell phone industry at CNET.
$500 would certainly be a great price for this, to have a completely unlocked phone that you could take to any carrier you want.
Keep in mind, Apple's iPhone can only be used with AT&T, and like most phones, the cheap version comes with a long-term contract and penalties for early cancellation.
People are becoming a little more sophisticated. They're willing to pay more and say, well, I'm going to be able to take this phone and use it overseas if I like, or I'll be able to switch carriers at will if I move or if I just don't like the service I get.
In an email yesterday, Google refused to reveal any details about a press event it's scheduled for next Tuesday or its new smartphone. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And I'll leave you with one last look back at the Christmas spirit. In Roseville, California, near Sacramento, it seems a Safeway store closed last Friday for the holiday, but accidentally left its doors open. NBC News talked to a local police officer about what happened next.
And a customer from inside the store said there was a lot of customers in the store. We went over there. There was actually a report of customers leaving money on the counter, purchasing merchandise.
That's right. No looting, no theft, money on the counter. Nice story as we say goodbye to 2009. This is Marketplace Morning Report. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
American Public Media.
Having your football team play in the Rose Bowl brings a whole lot of prestige to college athletic departments. Also,
even more money.
We believe the total impact on the greater LA area is going to be between $350 and $400 million for the both games. That's as good as it gets for us.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the cash behind those championships, next time on Marketplace from American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.